You're listening to a podcast from the Brookings Institution.
Ladies and gentlemen, good morning. I apologize for the slight delay while we worked out a few technical issues so that we can show you these slides. Thank you so much for joining us for another in our series of launches of public opinion polls by our colleague, non-resident senior fellow in the Saban Center, Shibli Tilhami, who is also, of course, the Anwar Sadat professor at the University of Maryland. This poll, which is a poll of Israeli public opinion, could not be better timed, I think, to give us some insight in the wake of truly head-spinning developments in the region and indeed here at home. We are going to be looking at data that was gathered just over the last week. In other words, in wake of the American presidential elections, in the wake of the announcement of new Israeli elections, and a lot of jockeying by Israeli politicians of the left, right, and center, and also data that reflects the Gaza crisis and its tentative ceasefire resolution. And we're looking at this data, of course, the morning after the UN General Assembly voted to recognize Palestine as a non-member state. So this is, like all polls, a snapshot of a rapidly moving picture. But I think it's one that comes at a crucial time as both the United States, the government of Israel, and governments around the world think about where we go next. And as Israelis contemplate the choices they face on January 22nd and think about where they would like to go next. I'd like to note as well that we're launching this poll on the morning before the Saban Center convenes its annual high-level Saban Forum U.S.-Israeli Strategic Dialogue. And we're very grateful to Shibli for making it possible to have this public event alongside that high-level dialogue. I'm going to briefly introduce Shibli, whom I think many of you know well. And along with Shibli, we have as a commentator on this public opinion data, Donna Weiss, who's the moderator of, I think, the biggest program on Channel 2, maybe the biggest program on Israeli TV, Meet the Press, and who has kindly joined us this morning and come to Washington for our strategic dialogue. Donna is not only an accomplished journalist, an accomplished interviewer, but also someone with a lot of deep insight into the Israeli political and legal system that she's practiced throughout her career. And we're really grateful that she can be here to provide some insight from the Israeli side on this poll. So the other thing I should mention is that Shibli's very graciously allowed me to give you a little preview of something that he's been working on for quite a while that will not be formally released until January, but that I wanted to highlight for all of you now because I think you can pre-order it on Amazon. And that is this fantastic edited volume, The Peace Puzzle, America's Quest for Arab-Israeli Peace, 1989 to 2011. I'm sorry, it's not an edited volume. It's a co-authored volume. And this is the result of a tremendous amount of research, primary interviews with key players across the history of the modern Arab-Israeli peace process. And I have no doubt it's going to be a definitive work. So Shibli, congratulations, and please look for this on Amazon or in bookstores in January. With that, Shibli, I'd like to ask you to give us a presentation. Thank you.
Good morning. It's always good to be here. Before I give you the results, let me just give you a little background on this poll. As you know, I do polls in the Arab world and in Israel annually. And this particular one, we actually timed it to come after the American elections to see how Israelis now see the prospects of U.S.-Israeli relations and also their perspective on major issues like Arab-Israeli issue and the issue of Iran. But as, in fact, we set out to go into the field just as the Gaza escalation took place, so we waited until after until the last day of the fighting. And we then added some questions that pertained specifically to the escalation. So this is really, really fresh. I mean, the first day of polling was last Wednesday, which was the day of the ceasefire. We did 150 interviews that day just before the ceasefire went into effect. And then the rest of the roughly 450 were done on Sunday and Monday. So the last day of interviewing was just this past Monday, and we didn't get the results until Tuesday. So you can imagine how we scrambled to analyze and get the results out. And for that, I really have to thank my partners. This poll is co-sponsored by the Sadat Chair at the University of Maryland and the Program for International Policy Attitudes with my colleague Steve Kull. And the staff has been extremely superb. I mean, Evan Lewis, Claire Ramsey, Abe Medoff, who really worked out, and others who worked very hard to analyze and get this stuff in place. This was fielded by Dahaf, the Dahaf Institute in Israel. It's a phone interview, 600, 510 Jews and 90 Arabs. So it's a national survey. For reasons of comparison, particularly with surveys that we've done among Jewish Israelis, we break it down into Jewish and non-Jewish. The reason we don't have the Arab sample specifically is that I conduct a fuller poll among Arabs where we really have, and they're usually face-to-face. I'll be doing one in the spring among 500 Arabs. 90 is not enough statistically to compare with a full sample. So we use it as part of the national sample, just to get a representative national sample. So with that in mind, I will go through it very quickly. Remember, by the way, that I'm not going to go over every finding that we have in the poll. We have posted all the results. You could find them, in fact, as of this minute, on brookings.edu or the Sadat website at the University of Maryland or the PIPA.org website. I mean, those are all there for you to follow up with the actual details of the question and more information. And if you have any questions about methodology as well, feel free to ask. Let's start with the Gaza war, since this is obviously something fresh. Do you believe that the fighting between Israel and the Palestinian groups in Gaza will end for good only when there is a political final status agreement, will only end through a major Israeli military campaign, will end if Israel reoccupies Gaza, will not end? And I think, look at the results, and I think there's a really big story to be told here. It seems straightforward, but it's much more complicated than that. Because when you look at it, I mean, look at there's not a huge difference between the overall and Jewish only here, so it doesn't matter what part you're looking at. But look at the overall for now. I mean, only 15% of Israelis think that this would end by a more extreme military operation. Only 12% think this would end if you reoccupy Gaza. So nobody really thinks there's a military solution to this. And that is, you know, that's clear. But the other thing that is clear, for those who want to argue that it'll end only through peaceful means and final settlement, you know, only 29% of Israelis overall think this would end with a final settlement agreement. And so you have 40% say it will not end. It's kind of a resignation that this is going to happen no matter what. And you know, essentially feeling that you have to do this over and over again. That's worth a discussion, because I think that's a very probably telling picture of where the public is on this one. Who, in your opinion, won the combat in the Gaza Strip? Remember, this is not about who won politically. It's really specifically about the fighting. Who you think performed better in some ways? It's hard to know how the public interpreted this, but it was very specific to combat, not to political victory. And here, again, you look, you know, neither side is the largest segment, nearly half, 45% saying neither side. 40% say Israel, 11% say Hamas. I just want to say one thing here about, I told you that the first day of polling was Wednesday, the last day of the fighting, just before the ceasefire went into effect. There were 156 interviews that day, and then 3 days later, the rest of it was conducted. So there was a little space after the ceasefire took hold. Now, overall, we didn't see major statistically significant differences between the polling on that day with the rest. But on this issue, we did see some move, though, again, not statistically significant, but some evidence that more people thought Hamas won after 3 days later than they did on Wednesday. Still a minority, but there was a larger minority in that sample. Now, is this, you know, is Israel in a better position or worse position compared with the period before the escalation? Again, you know, look at how divided Israelis are. The largest segment, especially among Jewish Israeli, interestingly, say it's the same, no change. But still, among those who think it there is a change, more people think it improved than think it gotten worse. So I think for now you'd have to say, yeah, they're divided, but the shift, you know, the slight edge to slightly better. U.S.-Israeli relations. This is a question that, is not a popularity question as such, because I ask that in the Arab world as well. I say that I'm trying to get at the prism through which people view the world when they answer this question. You know, what is it that's driving them when they answer a question? And I asked a similar question in the Arab world. It's been fascinating to see how that varied over time. I've asked that among Israelis for the past 3 years. I could tell you that, you know, this is an open question. We don't give them names. They can name anybody they want. So nobody really gets a huge majority. I mean, the largest anybody will get will be in the teens, generally. So it's not like we have some overwhelming winner of this. But it tells you something about who are the people that are on the public's mind. And I could tell you that the last 2 years, Angela Merkel of Germany was actually the favored world leader among Israelis, slightly more, actually quite a bit more than other leaders, getting, again, in the teens. Kind of an interesting historical fact that you might want to analyze a little bit. But this year, you wish. Obama hasn't done well. Bill Clinton has done much better historically. Usually Bill Clinton is number two. So look at this year. Among Jewish Israelis, where the comparison with, if you look at the bottom line, that is Jewish Israelis in November 2011, the last poll that we did, we had Merkel 12%, Clinton 10%, Obama 6%, and no one 32%, large number. But look at this. Obama is now number one on that list. You know, it's not a majority of Israelis, but he's favored over any other leader. He's very close. Certainly, you know, you could call it a tie. Certainly it is within, you know, if you take into account the margin of error. But that's quite a big shift for Obama. And it's, again, worth discussing in our conversation what happened here with Obama, coming particularly after the Gaza War. Certainly, he supported Israel during the Gaza War, was seen to have taken a public position supportive of Israel, and obviously opposed the Palestinian move at the UN. It's interesting to see that some of the same things that anger our public are the sort of things that may please the Israeli public's zero-sum game at one level. How would you describe your views of President Barack Obama of the United States? Again, for this we have history, and it's been increasingly positive. I mean, surprisingly, even last November, among Jewish Israelis, he had 54% of the people who said they had a favorable view of him. But there was a huge increase this year. I mean, 8 percentage points. Well, a significant increase. I wouldn't say huge increase, but a significant increase from 2011 to 2000 12. So that's, you know, goes with, again, identification of Obama as a favored leader. On American support for Israel, we tried to figure out whether the American public has a perception that whether the Israeli public had the perception that American public support is increasing or decreasing, and on two issues, in general or on security issues specifically. Well, actually, you know, there is not much really here to indicate any major shift. 40% say it stayed about the same, 27% say decreased, 30% say increased, roughly the same. But on security issues, we say it, thinking about the American public, is it your impression that its support for Israel's security needs has increased, decreased, or stayed about the same? You can see that 40% overall think that actually American public support for Israeli security needs have increased. And you wonder whether that's part of a function of all this rhetoric where both even the Israeli government was acknowledging that Obama was being supportive on that issue, certainly Barack. I wonder if that had something to do with it. Is it your impression that during the American presidential elections, Prime Minister Netanyahu supported the Republican candidate, the Democratic candidate, or stayed neutral? I mean, we know, you know, sort of where the American public thinks Netanyahu was. The question is, does the Israeli public see that, see the same thing? We you know, it's interesting. So, yes, they do. I mean, 61% say they supported, you know, that Netanyahu supported Romney. Among Jewish Israelis, even high, slightly higher, 64%. So that you know, that's obviously, you know, straightforward right here. But in President Obama's second term, how do you think the personal relationship between Prime Minister Netanyahu and President Obama will affect American support? Now, remember, that's sort of consequential for Israeli politics and election. You know, do they think that, you know, the fear that Obama is going to punish them or punish Netanyahu, is this going to happen? Now, we already saw some results, obviously, maybe influenced by the position of Obama on the Gaza war and the Palestinian bid at the UN, but we already saw that he, you know, that Israeli public warmed up to him anyway, but you could see here, too, they actually don't think it's going to make a difference. And even slightly more people think it's actually going to help the relationship rather than hurt the relationship. So a lot of confidence about the Israeli-U.S. relationship despite that background. That's fascinating to me. It's worth a discussion. I'd love to hear what Dana has to say about that because I think that's a very, you know, complicated issue. In its second term, do you expect the Obama administration relations to get warmer, stay about the same, or get cooler? Again, majority say stay about the same, but more people say it'll get warmer than cooler. The same story. Let me turn to Iran's nuclear program. Obviously, a huge issue that is likely to remain on the agenda in the next few months and maybe become bigger on the agenda for a variety of reasons. And so on this also we have track record, particularly among Jewish Israelis. We've asked questions in two different times before. This is a straightforward question. There is talk of a possible Israeli attack on Iran's nuclear facilities. Do you support or oppose the attack? We don't give them any context. We don't give them any information. We don't say with American support, without American support. We leave it to their imagination. Just kind of a, this is the plain choice. And you could see that overall, 50% oppose the attack, 38% support an attack. Among Jewish Israelis, a little closer. Israelis are clearly divided. Israeli Jews are clearly very divided. Really minor shift from 2011. Remember, the margin of error is plus or minus 4%. So this is pretty much, it hasn't changed since 2011. That's a year of roughly the same breakdown despite the Gaza war. Even in light of the Gaza war, there isn't a shift here. In regard to a possible Israeli military strike against Iran's nuclear facilities, what do you think Israel should do? strike without U.S. support, strike only with U.S. support, do not strike. So this is one where we introduce the U.S. separately. By the way, we don't sequence them one after the other. We separate them in the questionnaire so they don't, they have sort of, they have time to, space to think, to reflect on this. So what we get here is, again, no big difference from 2011, you know, and for that matter, from February 2012, where we also have the overall difference. We have 43% say strike only with U.S. support, 20% say strike without it. Among Jewish Israelis, only 18% say strike without without U.S. support. And again, note that one-third of Israelis consistently say don't strike, period, with or without U.S. support. That's been there. Likelihood of Iranian nuclear weapons. Now, this is a question, obviously, about the Israeli public assessment of whether Iran is likely to acquire nuclear weapons anyway, no matter what you do. And here's what we have. 87% of Israelis think that Iran will eventually have nuclear weapons. 87%. And actually, among Jewish Israelis, it's even higher. It's 92% who think Iran will eventually have nuclear weapons. Now, what do you believe the likely outcome would be if Israel strikes Iran? This is in terms of delaying Iran's nuclear program. How long would it delay it, or would it accelerate it? Again, you can see that you know, the percentage of people who think it would be delayed more than 5 years, you know, are a majority. Most people think it would be delayed more than 5 years. Less than 5 years. And a good percentage, 11%, say it would accelerate Iran's nuclear program. What do you think the U.S. reaction would be if Israel strikes Iran? Here you have only really few people think that the U.S. would punish Israel. You have 11% who say the U.S. is likely to punish Israel, a slight drop from February. 14% say it would stay neutral. The largest segment, 46%, say Israel would support the U.S. would support Israel diplomatically, but not militarily. About a quarter, 24%, say the U.S. would actually join the war with Iran. Very quickly, just on the idea of supporting a nuclear weapons-free zone in the Middle East, given verification, we give them all sorts of. It's a series of questions. I invite you to look at the. I'm not going to go through all of them. I invite you to look at the website or to see the series that we've done, and we've done it, repeated it from last time. But this is a bottom line question: whether they support a nuclear weapons-free zone that would include Israel and Muslim countries in the Middle East. And look at this. You have still a majority of Israelis supporting that, 58% favor, 35% oppose. It is a slight drop, actually, from 2011. 2011, we had 64% say they support it. This time around, 58% say. That's outside the margin of error. So there is a slight drop in the number of people. Making a deal with Iran, I'm just going to skip that for now. I'm just going to move to Syria because I want to turn very quickly to the conversation. You know, the Syria issue obviously is important for Arabs. It is important for the U.S. It's important internationally. It's certainly important to Israelis. And the question is, how do they see it? And one of the questions that we asked is, if the Syrian opposition were to gain power as compared to the Assad regime, do you think this would be better for Israel or worse for Israel? Just straightforward question about perception. Well, it's interesting because the number of people who think it would be worse for Israel is larger. It's 42%. 30% say it would be better for Israel. 11% say it wouldn't make a difference. Israel is pretty divided on this, but more think it would be worse. How would you characterize the current conflict in Syria? This is a question we also ask in the Arab world. Do you see it as mostly about ordinary Syrians seeking freedom? Is it mostly about Islamist groups trying to take power? Or is it mostly civil war among ethnic factions? Well, here too, the Israelis are really divided on this, and you can see that. I mean, more people say it's people seeking freedom, but if you add the other two groups together, it's certainly a big majority, people who think it's either Islamist groups or civil conflict. It's pretty significant, very, very divided, as is the case, by the way, in much of the Arab world. On Egypt, which of the following is closer to your view about the impact of the Arab Spring on Israel? Is it mostly, this is broad about the Arab Spring. Is it mostly worse, mostly better? Well, a slight majority of Israelis still think it's worse for them, that the Arab Spring has been worse for them. That has actually the number of people slightly increased from 2011 among Israeli Jews. How about President Morsi's policies toward Israel? Is it as they expected? Is it worse than they expected? Is it better than they expected? And here, too, the largest segment says about the same, particularly among Israeli Jews, 53%. And then they're divided about whether it's better or worse for Israel. So roughly the same, I would say. Israeli-Egyptian peace treaty. Do they think that it will remain in force in 4 years? It will remain in force but will be modified or it will be terminated? This is, again, a public assessment about their fears pertaining to the Israeli-Egyptian peace treaty that is obviously an important issue. Well, what you find is the largest segment, 41% overall, say that it will remain in force but will be modified. Only 17% overall and 16% among Jewish Israelis think it will be terminated. 36% say it will remain in force in its present form. So, obviously more people think it'll be modified. I'm going to finally turn to the Palestinian question. Obviously, this is a big day after the Palestinians succeeded in getting General Assembly support for a non-member state at the UN, potentially big. It opens up the question of negotiations. In fact, Palestinian Authority President Mahmoud Abbas said as he went to the UN that once this is approved, he's going to launch negotiations almost the next day. So there is some expectation that maybe something would happen on the negotiating front. But what are the prospects of that? Which of the following statements is closer to your view? I'm prepared for just peace based on the 67 borders, even if Arab states accept to recognize Israel, still oppose withdrawing from territories occupied in 67. You can see something here that is interesting because the number of people who straightforward say I'm prepared for just peace based on the 67 borders has declined, and we've seen that before, particularly among Jewish Israelis. So look at the last two lines. November 11, 43% said they're prepared for that. 2012, it's a big drop to 33%. So it doesn't seem to affect the roughly 30% who say even if the Arabs offer us all the peace, we still don't want to withdraw. That's about one-third. It's the middle category that has moved more to the right, one can argue. In 2002, Arab countries offered the Arab Peace Initiative, a comprehensive peace deal with Israel based on Israeli withdrawal from the territories occupied in the 67 war, and full peace agreements between Israel and all the Arab states. If this offer is renewed with support from Egypt's new government, how should the Israeli government react? Do you think it should accept the offer as proposed, accept the offer as the basis of negotiations, reject the offer? And as you know, there is an argument about certainly the peace camp in Israel, that, you know, if you revive the Arab Peace Initiative and you add Egypt as a kind of reinvigorating the Israeli peace treaty to this, it might sway some people. Well, I'm not sure. I mean, you find 46% of Israeli Jews say reject it outright. I mean, that's nearly half of Israelis say reject it outright. You have only 7% say accept the offer as proposed, and 43% say accept the offer as the basis of negotiations. So if you want to look at the half full, you could say slight majority, you know, favors either accepting it as is or accepting it with as a basis of negotiation. So Israelis are divided. We all know that, but it's very graphic. The issue here is moving more to the right. That's documented in the data. I'm going to give you a couple more examples of this. Which of the following statements are closest to your view about the prospects of lasting peace between Israel and the Palestinians? It will happen in the next 5 years. It is inevitable, but will take more time. I don't believe it'll ever happen. And look at this. Again, compare, look at the last two lines for comparison purposes. Among Jewish Israelis in 2011, we had 49% say it'll never happen. This year we have 55% say it'll never happen. Pessimism is increasing. By the way, it's the mirror image of what's happening on the Arab side. We've shown that in the polls, that you have an increase of people say it'll never happen because they're pessimistic. But you can see this very clearly moving to the right. Outcome, if the two-state solution collapses, that will be one-state solution, intense conflict for years to come. The status quo will continue, or the Palestinians will eventually surrender to Israeli power. Now, I give the same options in the Arab world, by the way, and in Arab polls in the Arab world, what I find the consistently, the overwhelming majority say there will be intense conflict for years to come. Very few people say there'll be one state. Very few people say Palestinians will give up power. Some people say status quo, but overwhelming majority say it will be intense conflict for years to come. That's what we used to get in Israel in the past. That has shifted over the past couple of years. And this is really an interesting story that also needs analysis. And Dana, I'd love your reflection on it. Because if you look at this result, you know, you have people, obviously a large segment, who say intense conflict for years to come, 35%. But you have even a slightly bigger segment of the public who said the status quo will continue. It's no longer a majority who think it'll be conflict for years to come, that they think the status quo will, that with intense conflict for years to come, but the status quo will continue. And that status quo, you can see, first of all, in 2011 to 2012, the number of people who say the status quo will continue increased from 47% to 42%. And I could tell you that in the previous year, from 2010 to 2011, there was also an increase in the number of people who say it'll be just the status quo, not intense conflict. And some Israelis are not particularly uncomfortable with the status quo. Obviously, the Gaza war is an exception to the rule. So it's a little bit less urgent, I think, in their mind. I'd love to hear Dana's comments on that. Obama's mediation in the Middle East, whether the president will be in a better position to help negotiate peace or not, not much change. You know, most people say 54% say his ability remains the same. Slightly more people think it'll be better than say it'll be worse. Just final point on internal Israeli dynamic and definition, Israeli identity particularly. Which of the following is your most important identity? We tell people that all their identities are important. I do the same thing in the Arab world, but we try to get to force them to choose in these questions. And look at this. This is only among Israeli Jews because we ask about Jewish identity. So 50% say Jewish identity trumps Israeli identity. And that is an increase, significant increase from 2011. I do note, however, that Israeli identity also has increased from 2011 to 2012. So you have kind of more of a polarization taking place. That polarization, by the way, shows up in another question, which is about the Jewishness of Israel and its democracy. You could see a split there. Which of the following is closer to your views? The Jewishness of Israel is more important to me than its democracy. Both are equally important. The democracy of Israel is more important to me than its Jewishness. And you could see here where Israelis are. They're obviously divided on this, but if you look at what happened from 2011 to 2012, it went from 27% to 31% for the Jewishness of Israel is more important to me, but also the democracy is more important to me went up from 26% to 33%. The one that diminishes both equally important. So you have a polarization. It's exactly what we're seeing. You know, there's more polarization in Israeli politics. The middle is shrinking. And how would you describe the current status of Arabs in Israel? And this obviously, you know, pertains in some ways to the identity of the state, but also in terms of whether they think there's equality. So we give them three options. There is full equality between Arab and Jewish citizens. There is legal equality, but institutional societal discrimination. And it is more like an apartheid arrangement or relationship. And so we have these three options. And so first of all, we didn't find considerable change from last time among Jewish Israelis, particularly given the margin of error, plus or minus four. Overall, you could see, you know, where it's at. Basically, the largest segment, majority, 55%, say there's legal equality but institutional discrimination. 28% say there is full equality. 12% say it's an apartheid relationship. But note, among Jewish Israelis, it's only 8%. So this is the combination of Arab and Jewish for the 12%. So with that, I'm going to end and invite my colleagues to the stage for a conversation. Thank you very much.
And while my colleagues are getting settled and putting on their microphones, let me just take a minute to express my thanks to the Project on International Policy Attitudes, PIPA, which is in the back. So thank you very, very much. You've been an incredible partner for Shibley and for us in this series of polls, and we're delighted to keep working with you. Okay. Thank you. So, Donna, Israelis seem divided on a lot of major issues in the region, how to think about Syria, whether to conduct military strikes on Iran. There's one thing they seem to have a much more unified view on, which is pessimism about Middle East peace and their relationship with the Palestinians. They're not prepared for peace. They think violence will continue even if there's a final negotiated agreement. What lesson do we draw from this?
Well, first of all, thank you so much for having me. It's a privilege and an honor. And thank you, Shibley, for the fascinating data. The first thought, watching these slides, not reading it, I thought, Israelis must be crazy. Because here they are living in a country where they know, they believe, there's not going to be a solution. Gaza is going to keep on throwing rockets on them. They've just had, it's amazing. I was the first... the bombed rocket that hit Tel Aviv, I was in the fitting room with my son. He was buying jeans for a bar mitzvah. He had to go. And I saw, there's a missile on Tel Aviv. And I said to the, just get me another pair of jeans. Because, it's like, so this is part of life already, also in Tel Aviv and Rishon. They believe that Iran is going to acquire a nuclear bomb no matter what. And they hear the elitists saying that, it wants to wipe Israel off them. So why are they so happy? Because in all the polls that you do in Israel, people say that they love their life and they're very happy. Well, I think, why aren't they going away? What kind of people are there? Well, you could go for the, if I were official government speaker, I would say this is Zionism. Zionism was all about, doing and swimming against the currents. I'm not an official spokesperson. And I think the reason is because they have become addicted to the status quo. And you see that very clearly in your slides. And I think the personal, the most influential person in the past years is Ehud Barak in that sense. And he just got a medal from the Defense Secretary of Defense for outstanding. And he's just left us, you know, dramatically. He's just announced that he's quitting. I think we might see him back. But anyway, he doesn't want to be dragged through the elections and to find himself without voters, because it's amazing. No one wants to vote for Ehud Barak, but they want him as defense minister, and he's the best copywriter of our time. And he told the Israeli public two things, and they take his word on it. First of all, he came back in 2000, and he said, there is no one to talk to. And from the moment Ehud Barak, who was the hope, the new Rabin, the successor of Ben-Gurion, as he sees himself, stood up and said, I was the person who was going to bring you peace, and I failed. I tore the mask off the other side, and there is no one to talk to. That has shrunk into the public opinion and has grown throughout the years. And the second thing he has told the people in Israel, that we are a villa in the jungle. It's a tough neighborhood. The Arab Spring has just made it even tougher in Israelis' eyes, but we are a villa. And if you want the fact that the Israelis came out of this conflict with the Iron Dome being the hero, for them, that is the solution. The status quo can go on because we're smarter, we have better technology, we have found a way to improve our life despite the neighborhood. So that is something that is making the urgency, mm-hmm. the feeling of urgency of Israelis, it's lacking in some way. Now, you could say that the Gaza operation should have been a wake-up call, because here we have a right-wing government, dream team right-wing government. We have Lieberman and Netanyahu. You couldn't dream of a right-wing government, okay? And they let all these missiles, long-range missiles, go into the Gaza. It's on their term. It didn't happen before. Missiles couldn't reach Tel Aviv before, okay? But they had 4 years of quiet. So we had a 8 days operation. It ended okay. No one was, there were only six casualties on the Israeli side. I don't care about the other side. We had the world stand in an okay manner. We can go on. So I think basically that is the tragedy. They have become, Israelis have become addicted to the status quo. They heard Barak saying there's no one to talk to, so there's no one to talk to. And they're a villa in a jungle. Now, who doesn't want to live in a villa? So I think, you know, basically, just to start off, I think that is that. And I think one more thing. They heard Nasrallah say Israel is a spider web society. Once you attack the citizens, not the soldiers, it will crumble. And we will throw rockets on them, and we will finish the story. Well, they woke up and they said, Nasrallah's in the bunker. That's how Barak keeps on saying, Nasrallah's in the bunker. And we have Iron Dome, and we are a strong society. So this sense of strength, on the one hand, although we're always the constant victim, you know, Israelis is like Samson the Nebuch. We're always the constant victim in the region, is very tragical for those who think we need a solution in the region.
So Barak has apparently persuaded a significant sector of Israelis that they're stuck with what they've got, and what they've got is okay. And it sounds to me like what you're describing and what we see in the data, not only this poll, Shibley, but the ones that you've produced in the past, that there's a sort of passivity, enough satisfaction with what's going on, a belief that nothing they do could make it better, so let's just stick with what we've got. Last night, we did a film screening of a new documentary about the state-building project by Salam Fayyad, the Prime Minister of the Palestinian Authority. And he spoke afterwards, and he said, he talked about the Gaza crisis as a doctrinal defeat for the path that he has represented, which he described as the peaceful path to freedom for Palestinians. So on the Palestinian side, there's a sense of urgency, but certainly for Salam Fayyad and the PA, not much they can do about it. On the Israeli side, there are many actions they could take, but a sense of passivity. Shibley, do you think that there's anything that could shift Israeli public opinion in the direction of a more active approach?
Well, you know, the part of it, of course, it's about an assessment of prospects. And I always say that, that sort of if you think that it is possible to make a deal, you immediately see a shift. The problem over the past decade is that we have had, both on the Arab side and the Israeli side, is a bet of people saying it's impossible for whatever reason. They make an assessment that it's not going to happen, even if they really wanted to make peace. The Palestinians feel that, the Arabs outside feel that. And so what you have, it's really a betting game in some ways. So people are betting, and you could see how pessimistic they are. So that shifts. Now, if you're going to create a shift within a public opinion environment, of course it could happen. It happens in two ways. One way is that you actually do have a shifting assessment for some campaign that people can really believe in, and then it rallies and shifts public opinion. Because it offers them some way out. I mean, people don't, I mean, in the Arab world, you have the same thing, where you have people say, I'm prepared for a two-state solution, two-thirds. I don't think it's going to happen, over 55%. And yet, if it doesn't happen, I think it's going to be violence for years to come. No good. They don't have an option. So they are looking for a way out, both Israelis and Arabs. So you have to create something that they can believe in. Who's going to do that? And now the problem is that, you know, outside, you know, whether it's going to be American mediation, can America do it, or the narrative. So what happens in this thing is that when you know, if you're a politician, an Israeli politician, Arab politician, if you are betting that the prospects of peace are small anyway, that then it's a zero-sum game. So you want to mobilize your public behind a tough stand that you're going to take. And so you're swaying them. You help swaying them to the right. There's no way out of it. It is, I think, in some ways reinforced by something that Dana said that's really important about the psyche. It's not just the status quo. There is this part of the Israeli projection of power, even as Israel says, we're insecure, and Israelis are insecure. I mean, inside they feel insecure. But there is this projection of confidence, you know, about the Iron Dome is an example, but a projection of confidence about Israeli military superiority, Israeli advantages, Israeli seeing the Arab weaknesses, seeing the division. There is this thing of buying into a narrative of strength that, not without fear, but a narrative of strength that really is very hard to break in this environment. That's why I think the pessimism is pervasive.
That's fascinating. You know, Dana Shibley is saying that the Israeli public is searching for someone to offer them solutions. Elections are coming up January 22nd. There's very strong electoral prospects on the right, and the left and the center left seem fragmented, divided. Is there a vacuum there that Israeli politicians can fill?
That is an interesting question. And I think, Shibley, you touched on the point that the Israeli public is schizophrenic. It's amazing. On the one hand, they are always with a constant feeling of victim. You know, we always have these on the news. Why don't you show how the press shows how only the Palestinian side of the story, and they don't show how the lives of more than 2 million civilians, no one would tolerate it. I mean, you wouldn't tolerate missiles on Washington. You don't want to go through it, and you wouldn't tolerate it. I have three boys, and I looked at them, and I said, what do I have to tell them about the life in Israel? So, but again, Israelis always feel that their story isn't portrayed right in the world, yet they do feel superior regarding power, brain, you know, ingenuity, and whatever. The startup nation, which is also the constant victim. But elections are coming, and it's interesting. And now there's an amazing catch-22, which, you know, it really, I have no answer for that. Oh, it's good because we have to ask questions. Here's the catch, okay? Netanyahu's ratings We do a monthly approval rating for Netanyahu on my show. Twice he rocketed, when he freed Gilad Shalit, and when he stopped the operation, and he didn't conquer Gaza. So twice, when Netanyahu betrayed his, he wrote books on it. Someone said that, you know, you can sue him for buying his books. This is Netanyahu's belief, and he betrayed them twice, and when he betrayed them twice, he got the highest ratings. And then, the minute after, it's election times, they go back to the same right-wing rhetorics, and the public want that, and they will vote that, and they will go to the right. So that's very interesting, and I think what happened is the right called the left bluff and said, there's no one to talk to. We're getting missiles. We withdrew out of Gaza, and we got missiles. What did we get back? What did we get back? We withdrew from Gaza. We didn't get nothing. Olmert offered everything to Abu Mazen, to Mahmoud Abbas, and he didn't even come back. Two sentences you always hear. Okay? So people listen, and they say, okay, left, finished. But the left didn't come up and say, now, what happened to your values and your beliefs? Why don't you execute them? You are the dream team right-wing government. Please annex the territories. Go ahead. Please, you know, tell the United States we're going to do whatever we want to do. Conquer Gaza. Who's, you know, you have the strongest government. Why aren't you doing that? Instead of calling the right-wing bluff, what they're doing is they're disguising themselves as center. If you look at Shelly Yachimovich, which is a brilliant politician.
She's the leader of the Labor Party.
She took a party of 8 seats. Now there are 24, 25 in the polls. It's really unbelievable what she did. She will not talk about the Palestinian issue. She only talk about social issues and economical issues. And she's trying to get voters from the extreme right. She says, it doesn't matter. We all agree. So everyone is disguising. Tzipi Livni now. I am the leader of the center. To be a left in Israel is, to a certain extent, it's something you're supposed to be ashamed of. When someone wants to insult someone else, they say he's a left, okay? So instead of calling the bluff of the right, everyone, all the leaders in that vacuum are disguised as center because they want to take the 30% who think the status quo is okay. They want to take them to their side. And one quick, I think the most important thing that happened, again, I think, you know, if you want to process, it's something to take into consideration. First of all, the disengagement from Gaza has left people with the understanding that if you pull back from territories, you get missiles. That's very important. They heard their leaders promise, we will not tolerate missiles on Shderot. We will not tolerate missiles, and then they came. We will not tolerate missiles on Ashkelon, and then they came. We will not tolerate missiles on Ashdod, and then they came. We will not tolerate missiles on Tel Aviv, and they came. So people understand that if you withdraw from territories, you get missiles. And even those who support negotiations do not support negotiations for the thought that they will reach peace and they will make life better in Israel. They only support negotiations because they think it's better for Israel tactically. Tzipi Livni, Ehud Olmert, all the politicians from the center-right, when they talk about the need to go into a process, they never say we will reach peace. No one thinks peace will be reached in the near future, some, as you saw.
The data shows.
But they say it's better for Israel to negotiate because it will get legitimacy, worldwide legitimacy, to go on with its policies regarding Iran military actions, mm-hmm. go on regarding Hamas military actions. So that is the biggest
shift. So peace process, but not peace.
Right, yeah, the process. What's important is the process, not the peace.
Mm-hmm. Wow, okay. At this point, I'd love to open it up for questions from the audience. We'll have a microphone coming around, and let me ask you two things. First, please identify yourself, and secondly, please make sure it's...
We didn't talk about Obama, though.
We didn't, and I'm sure we'll get some questions about Obama.
So someone ask about Obama.
Yeah, please, ask about Obama, and
President
please
Obama.
Make it
yeah.
A question, that's one. Let's start with Gary Mitchell.
thanks very much. I'm Gary Mitchell, and I write the Mitchell Report, and I want to come to this point that you were just talking about, which is if you withdraw from the territories, you get missiles. A lot of people believe, and we heard that multiple times from people on this stage, that if Sharon had withdrawn from Gaza, not unilaterally, but arm in arm with Abu Mazen, that the lesson might have been very different, which was that the withdrawal was a result of a peaceful agreement, giving Abu Mazen some credit for that. Instead, it was read as getting the hell out because we were getting beat up. So it's a two-part question. One, A, that is a point of view that was expressed a lot here, and by here I mean in Washington and at Brookings, by various and sundry people.
I'll plead guilty. I wrote that in the Washington Post.
Yeah. is that a fair assessment, number one? And number two, if that's the case, are the Israelis capable of understanding that?
That's a very good question. I think that the short answer is no. They don't think, and frankly, I'm not sure that it would have made such a big difference. But the longer answer is that you have to understand that when Sharon, because it's not just about the disengagement, it's about the whole set of mind of the Israeli leadership. When Sharon went ahead with the disengagement, at that stage, he used to call Abu Mazen, Mahmoud Abbas, a hen without feathers. Mm-hmm. He was perceived to be very weak. He was perceived to be a footnote in the Palestinian history. Later on, it was only later on that his head of staff, Dov Weisglass, found Abu Mazen to be a strong leader that he is, and now he talks about it. I mean, Abu Mazen has changed. It's not the same Abu Mazen. Then I think Sharon thought it's better off we disengage from Gaza and they'll leave us with the rest of the issues. It was always a trade-off. It's always a trade-off. We give him that, we get that. Always tactical. Now, you have to remember that the biggest mistake in Gaza was the elections that the Americans insisted on. The Bush administration insisted on elections. The Israeli administration tried hard to prevent those elections, understanding that Hamas would gain power, and Hamas did gain power. But I think that if I were a Palestinian living in Ramallah, I would, as Salam Fayyad said yesterday, would think that the only people who get things done in the region are the Hamas, because as they always say, Israel only understands power. Now, I addressed this question to Yaakov, just last week, Yaakov Amidror, who is the security advisor for Netanyahu, General Amidror. And I said, well, what would a Palestinian think? And he said, well, I'll tell you what. The Palestinian living in Ramallah, it's an amazing answer. The Palestinian, you ask a Palestinian where he prefers to live. Does he prefer to live in Ramallah, or does he prefer to live in Gaza? It's the same answer you get when people talk about the discrimination of Arab citizens in Israel. Well, the right always say, well, where could they be better off? In Syria? In Egypt? So it's, they answer you through, you know, where are they better off? But I do think that it was a strategical set of mind not to strengthen the Palestinian Authority. And even now, the bottom up mm-hmm. is, we'll keep it quiet.
You know, just to add to this, I mean, it's not like, it's at the core of a political dilemma. It's not like there are no Israelis who know that peace agreements are better. I mean, look at the Egyptian-Israeli peace treaty, even the Israeli public in this environment of an Islamist-led government, they don't think the Israeli peace treaty will be abrogated, even with the tension, you know, over time. It's been since 1979. So that it's better. And a lot of Israelis understand that Gaza is not independent. I mean, the narrative of Israel is pulled out of Gaza, therefore, as if Gaza became independent. But, you know, theoretically and functionally, Gaza is still under occupation. And as a consequence, you know, for an Israeli leftist could make the argument.
Why are you pointing at
me? No, no, on Israeli. You're to my left, you see.
Okay.
Could make the argument that, you know, that what Israeli would want to be under occupation for what day. It's not just what Israeli would come under attack for what day. But to make that argument, you have to have a political purpose for it. And when you don't think there's a peace process or you're not going to rally for an option, you back down, particularly in terms of conflict. So that's why people withdraw from that argument, and they leave the space for the narrative on the right, and that's the one that dominates. So nobody has the clout to make that case.
Thank you.
Just one quick reply.
You know, the question is time. Is time on our side, on the Israeli side, or on the Palestinian side? Now, if you come from a perspective saying it's imperative we get a deal now because the windows of opportunity, as President Peres is saying, is closing.
Or Livni's argument that the demographics are working
right
against Israel.
Then you would say it's urgent for us to reach an agreement. I'm trying to share with you that you know, the majority of Israel's public, they feel time is on Israel's side, and that goes back to the essence of Zionism, because time is on the side of who makes good use of it, and they're making good use of it. The standard of living is rising. Israel's high-tech industry is booming. Here we have Iron Dome, the best, you know, another Israeli invention. So we're making use of time. So that's a critical aspect when they think about where are we going.
Thank you. Thank you. Good point. Let's take two or three questions from the floor, and then we'll come back up for comments on the aisle right here, the gentleman in the gray jacket.
Do you want some water?
Thank you. Yeah, from the Jerusalem Report. Did you ask...
Hold it right up to your mouth.
You ask the question what Israelis think about the importance, whether settlements are an obstacle to peace or not?
Okay, and if you could just pass the microphone down to the lady down the aisle with her hand up right there.
Karen Hudis, Legal Department of the World Bank. I was the country lawyer for Jordan for 20 years and was working on water issues. And, of course, there's the Johnston Agreement, which is a 50-year-old de facto agreement. My question is two-part. The first is, what do very accurate stakeholder analyses using computer game theory tell us about the conflict in the Middle East? And I'd be happy to talk to any of you after the program about that. I am guardedly optimistic because I think there's one thing on everybody's side, and that's the rule of law. And the question is, what is the distance, the de facto situation now in rule of law and getting to rule of law? Because I think that's the only answer to the conflict.
Thank you. If you could pass the mic back to the aisle, to Jose, then... this young lady right here in the green sweater.
I'm Sally Kaplan. I'm the intern at PIPA. I was wondering, given his role as mediator in the recent ceasefire agreement, are Israelis expressing confidence in Morsi as a potential key player in future peace negotiations?
Okay, thank you. Short, sharp question. And nobody, if you just pass it back to the aisle, thank you. Nobody yet has asked about President Obama. Who has a question about President Obama? Okay, I'll ask a question about President Obama. I have to say, my response to your data, Shibley, is what a fickle public. But then, of course, we know that American public opinion can be incredibly fickle on these popularity or positivity rating, temperature-taking questions. And we've seen it, too, in the Arab world, their favorite world leader, what they think of the United States going up and down. What do you think?
Mostly down.
Mostly down. What do you think accounts for this really notable positive shift for Obama, and what room do you think it gives the United States?
So. It's interesting. I mean, there could be multiple things going on at the same time. One thing is that Israeli public attitudes toward Obama were never as bad as they were being reported, or never as bad as the Israeli government projected. And we've seen that even from day one, even when people saying, Tom Friedman wrote right after the election that his ratings were below the margin of error or something like that. I,
I remember something like that. That was actually not true on the public level. So he, first of all, it wasn't always, it was better than people had assumed. Number two, they had already improved dramatically, really by 2010 and 2011, particularly after the speech he gave at the United Nations. We recorded that last year in November. Number four, they were led to believe that, well, you know, if Obama wins, then he's going to, quote, throw Israel under the bus. Well, he wins, and turns out he was extremely supportive of Israel on the Gaza issue, and then opposed, remarkably opposed, I think a big mistake, my own personal view, the Palestinian bid at the UN. I think it's, given where the administration was, I think it was probably, and it might be seen historically as a big mistake. But nonetheless, he supported them. And so given all of that, I think you can see that people, you know, warmed up to him over time. But I'm curious to know if that's your take.
Well, first of all, you did the poll after the Gaza, so that's very important. You know, I think in popularity, we are now a culture which is so used to texting who we want on the reality show and who we want. You know, popularity is so connected to the reality program culture. So we like you this week. Next week, we'll text you off the show. Mm-hmm. So that's very important, I think. And Israel's society is very, you know, it has a short memory, and now they like him. The next week, they won't like him. But I think we did polls on our show, and before the American elections, and Romney was the favorite, mm-hmm. by large. He was. People in Israel, because we're shifting right. Okay, mm-hmm. It's an interesting. The shift in the Israel society is kind of in the wrong, different direction from the shift in the American society. So they're shifting apart. I think it's interesting. But anyway, Romney was perceived to be, you know. But here comes President Obama, very smartly, I think, in the interests of Israel. You can argue what it makes of America in the region. But here he comes and he puts aside what everyone is expecting. You know, his revenge. And, you know, surprising Israel with talking to the prime minister on the phone and giving us, Israelis were very offended when the White House released a picture where President Obama was speaking to the phone with Netanyahu and putting his feet on the table. So this time, you know, these things matter to the public. And this time they released a picture where he was taking the time in his Burma historical tour, and he was sitting down and speaking. So it was very big on the news. Here was President Obama respecting Netanyahu, although Netanyahu was, you know, you saw, everyone understood who he favored. So the interesting point for me is, if they finally take him on his word that Israel's security matters and the ties have never been stronger and whatever, will they take his word on the fact that he keeps on saying he will not tolerate a nuclear Iran, that he will not, all the options are still on the table? My assessment is that it will be harder for Netanyahu today to do anything without the support or the green light of the states, because you have to remember, the biggest and best pollster in Israel is Benjamin Netanyahu. He knows how to read the public. He knows, otherwise he wouldn't have freed Gilad Shalit and he wouldn't have stopped the operation in Gaza. He's very, very strong in polling. So I think that the public now said, okay, Obama wasn't that, you know, he didn't really throw us off the bus. Maybe he'll be right about Iran, and maybe he's not, but we're not, we need America. We still need America. We need some more iron domes. So we need America. So that could be an interesting point.
So it does maybe give the U.S. a little more space with the Israeli public. Okay, we had questions on Morsi, on game theory and the conflict, and on settlements. So
just very quickly, I have not asked in this poll about settlements, but obviously a lot of pollsters do in Israel, and we have a little bit of an understanding of where Israelis are. Historically, majorities opposed settlement, but that majority, went down over time. I haven't looked at the most recent ones in Israel. On Morsi, you can see we just asked. We didn't ask are your views are positive or negative, because of what I expect, they're going to be more negative for sure. That's why I used the different measure, which is he better than you expected or worse than you expected? Because we know what they expected. Principally, and it looks like generally it's roughly as they expected, which is
they're uncomfortable with him, but it is interesting to look at the consequences, because that question about the Egyptian-Israeli peace treaty, it is in part about him, which is, do you think they're going to go to abrogate the treaty? Well, you have only a small minority, like 17 or 18% say they're going to abrogate the treaty. Most say that they won't. Final question on game theory. By the way, I don't know if you knew that I was actually a game theorist in an earlier life. But
I thought so that was a planted question
for you, actually. But I won't answer it because I'm not sure that I could tell you something in game theory that I couldn't tell you in my own words that would inform you about the dilemma that they're in.
Okay. I wanted to ask you whether that question about Morsi or about Egypt more broadly, have you done similar questions in past polls of Israelis? How does this, well, it's about what we expect, link up to what they actually expected in previous polls?
Well, we didn't ask them about Morsi, as you know. I mean, he wasn't even, I mean, right. Remember when he was elected.
He's the accidental president.
So we asked them, obviously, about what they would expect after Mubarak. And overwhelmingly, Israelis thought it was going to get worse because, you know, Mubarak was seen as Israel's, you know, ally. And they knew that wasn't going to return. So the expectations were negative. Now, how negative, I don't think, I certainly didn't measure every bit of that, but clearly it's not as negative as people think when you look at the assessment of what might happen to the peace treaty.
Yeah, he gained a lot of points after his role in the last events in Gaza. I think the biggest, and you see it when people react to the Arab Spring. Mm-hmm. People in Israel were used to talking to the leaders. It was enough to cut a deal with the leaders. Now we are in a region where it is important to talk to the people. America is going to, understanding this, but again, mm-hmm. acting, I think, in the traditional manner, and it's interesting to see where it will take them. But also in Israel, people are understanding. That's why they want to hang on to Assad. It's amazing because there are a lot of, I mean, even Lieberman was very clear on the fact that Israel should extend humanitarian aid and the atrocities there, and we have families in the Golan Heights, the Druze who have relatives in Syria, and yet the public wants to hang on to Assad because the devil you know is better than the devil you don't know.
By the way,
know.
That's not what it says. I mean, the poll says not that they want to hang on to Assad. They just think that it will probably get worse.
Okay, yeah. So they prefer Assad. Not Assad, but they prefer the situation, the status quo again. They prefer the status quo. It's always about what you know. But I think we have come to a point where we have to talk to the people. And that is a big shift and a challenge for the Israeli public. And you have to remember we have a public going to the right. You know, it's a fact. When you pressure a people, they go to the right. It's true about Gaza. When Israel pressured the people, they didn't go up into the government and say, change the government. They became more...
What about the 73 war?
In what sense?
It moved toward peace.
Yeah, that's right.
Because they felt they were defeated. Mm. And we had a leader who was Menachem Begin. They trusted, he was a right-wing leader. They trusted him, and he did, and they were so...
That's right, it was the defeat of the Labor Alliance that allowed
exactly,
him
they
to
felt
come
that
in
the labor
that.
Betrayed them, and here was the right-wing leader, and they said, we'll trust you, you go ahead. There was leadership. At the end of the day, Ben-Gurion always said, do what the people need, not what the people want. And I believe that if Netanyahu in the second, I think, second term, I think, I mean, it's a given, but we have to say, we thought it would be boring elections, and they're very interesting so far. But anyway, if Netanyahu gets reelected, if he decides to go ahead with an agreement, we saw that the public is with him. And when he betrays his values, the public is with him again. So if he wants, people will go after him if he wants an agreement.
Mm-hmm. Does he?
You know, when he was elected, there was a debate whether President Peres would say, would he be Begin, who went and did the peace treaty with Egypt, or would he be Yitzhak Shamir, the right-wing leader who was dragged to Madrid and was the staunch believer of status quo? I don't know. Frankly, I don't think anyone knows.
Mm-hmm. Time will tell. Time will tell. Well, we started late, and there are several of you who've been very patient, so I'm going to try and take three last questions and then come to you for answers and closing comments. I do want to note, for those of you who are interested in Israel's view of the crisis in Syria, we've just published a brand new analysis paper by Itamar Rabinovich, who's sitting in the back of the room. And you can find it on the Saban Center website at brookings.edu/Saban. So, Jose, we'll start right here.
Yes, hi. For Donna, you mentioned that Israelis think they have time on their side, and I've certainly heard the same thing from many Israelis. Given that, though, given the increasing economic, I mean, just forget about the Israeli-Palestinian conflict and the Arab Spring, given the increasing economic polarization in Israel and the recent demonstrations over the past year or two, and also the increasing religious polarization and ethnic polarization and the growing foreign worker underclass.
You can give the whole list. You're not going to get us unhappy. I told you the Israeli public are schizophrenic.
So you've just answered my question. I was going to say, do you think time is on Israel's side?
Personally, well, I always try to remind myself of my favorite interviewee is President Peres, because you always get a headline and it's always interesting. And it's amazing to sit in front of him because, you know, he's been everywhere and he's done everything. So he always says that pessimists and optimists die the same but live differently. And coming from a person who's 92 and is still thinking about becoming prime minister in the next election, you have to listen. So I want to be optimistic. I think that taking demographic shifts, political shift, and regional shifts, and the change in America's interests, long-term interests in the region, which I think are dramatic and will unfold in this presidency but also in the next one. And you see with Asia rising and I'm fearful that Thomas Friedman's words that in our region the extremists go all the way and the moderates tend to go away might be an option. And then I wake up and I look around and I say, well, this country is a miracle in any sense, and it's already been here for 100 years. I think these elections are very crucial. I think Israel has reached a T-point junction, and you can either go right and execute the right, or you should try and clearly and say we have to find a solution because demographics and because we have to. And I fear the fact that the Israeli political system is stuck in the center, trying to find a center. I don't believe in center. I believe that it's better that you have two ways of thinking and then you try and work it out. And I fear the fact that it's always a unity government. It's not an opposition. So I think we are at a very crucial point. I did find a lot of I was surprised personally. This is my personal point of view, and even a bit. Points for my optimistic side on the way this government dealt with the Gaza conflict. Here again, you would have thought it would have dealt with it differently. Netanyahu proved to be very
pragmatic.
Responsible. Lieberman was pragmatic, was responsible. The previous government was the government, Ehud Olmert, who said, we're going to go in and show them that we have gone crazy. Yeah. And on the first day, of Operation Castlet, which was led by a center government, they killed 89 police officers. They bombed and here, I mean, there were casualties on the other side, and most of them were terrorists. But there were casualties, but the intention. This was the right-wing government telling the army, be very, very careful, for tactical reasons, for whatever. So, you know, there's a saying. Ariel Sharon was famous when they asked him, "Why did you dis-?" I mean, this is the forefather of the settlements. All of a sudden, become a left-wing merits. so they said, "Things that you see from here, you don't see from there." So at the end, reality is stronger. But there is a point about time. you know, a growing number of Israelis, especially from the right wing and from the settlements, believe that this Arab Spring is good in the sense that Jordan will change and the Palestinians will finally find their national aspirations in Jordan. And that's why they think time, again, is on their side. Mm.
Well, I'm going to be a little bolder on this one because I think that I don't agree that time is on Israel's side. And not because of the demographics. I mean, this demographic argument to me is problematic morally anyway because I think the problem of occupation is not about whether Israel or not will be comfortable. It's a different kind of issue. But I think it's more about, you know, when I look at the history, Israelis are incredibly ingenious people. They're technologically more advanced than anybody else. If you look at the strategic picture, they can defeat any combination of Arab states today, and the Arab world is in disarray, for sure. But if you look at the incredible leveling of the field globally in the information revolution, the technological spread over time, if you look at when the Israelis came close to a defeat, it wasn't when they were not powerful or when they were not ingenious. They're extremely powerful, extremely ingenious. It is when they didn't take Arabs seriously. They didn't take Arabs seriously. That happened in 73, when they didn't take the Egyptians seriously enough, both in terms of the motivation to end occupation or that they could find a way to compensate for the inequality of power. And it happened in 2006 when Hezbollah kept raining rockets for 5 weeks, the same number the last day as the first day, something that wasn't in Israel's planning. And even in this one, where limited, you know, confined people under occupation are shooting, you know, rockets into Israel, and not Israel is not able to stop it through military means. So if I look at it that way, I would say if you had to predict who's going to win the next round of fighting and the next round of fighting and the next round of fighting, yes, Israel. Because you're looking at it from the point of view of balance of power, and if you're betting, that's where you'd bet. But to assume that that is a constant environment, that there aren't always surprises, and to take the Arabs not seriously, I think is a grave mistake, a historical mistake. And I think that's the lesson that needs to be learned.
Ladies and gentlemen, this has been such a fascinating discussion. I want to ask you to join me in thanking Shibli Tilhami for this wonderful poll and Donna for your comments. Thank you.